Does anyone have any questions from discussion group they would like to bring up?
We talked about dealing with anger, and we discussed about the situation in which anger rises, like in a conversation or when we are fighting.
Sure.
So we talked about a situation when other people is angry about us.
Mm-hmm.
Then the best thing to do is to tame our anger. But what I thought about is when somebody is approaching to us with violence.
Sure.
So what is the answer of the reason to that? Because then I don't think that
sure,
we do
sure,
enough.
Sure. So, as I mentioned, I think earlier, when we talk about these sorts of situations, generally in Buddhism, the answer is not to react with anger, because often when we get angry, particularly when we're very angry, we're out of control, we're not really seeing the situation very clearly, and we often overreact. And if it's a physical confrontation, we often use excessive force, unnecessary force in our reaction. So usually the answer you'll see or hear, according to Buddhism, is patience. But then people sometimes think, oh, okay, I have to like sit there and do nothing. This is not patience. Patience is not a behaviour. Patience is a mental attitude. So again, if someone is threatening us or verbally abusing us or whatever, to try to remain calm and not get agitated. Because if we get agitated, we often don't see the situation very clearly, which means we've got less chance of responding in a good way. So therefore, if we can remain patient, meaning simply remain calm and see very clearly what the situation really is, then we've got a better chance of responding in the best possible way. And we can respond if it's a difficult situation, the force we can use to respond forcefully is compassion. Because compassion, which we're going to talk more about, of course, day after tomorrow, compassion is not just this sort of like sitting there smiling and saying nice things to people. This is not compassion. Compassion is really wishing that person to be free of suffering and its causes. And of course, the causes of suffering is the mental afflictions. So if we actually just sort of sit there and smile and allow them to continue to verbally abuse us or physically attack us, that's not very compassionate, because we're sort of contributing them towards them behaving badly more, to increasing their habit of acting badly. So that is absolutely not compassion. That's opposite of compassion. So therefore, with compassion, wanting them to be free of suffering, wanting them to be free of mental afflictions, we can, if they're being very forceful physically, attacking us, we can use force to restrain that person as best we can. So this is how we can forcefully deal with that situation in that way. Okay? Is there anything more I missed in your question? It's okay. The thing is with Buddhism, the important thing is the attitude. And how we actually respond or what we do will depend entirely on the situation. There's no book you can go to that says, do this. Buddhism says, in any situation, remain calm, have a compassionate attitude, and use your wisdom to respond. And we have to evaluate every situation individually, because every situation is unique. And so all we can do is, again, remain calm with a compassionate attitude, using our wisdom to clearly try and see what's going on, and then using our compassion and wisdom, decide how to respond. And of course, sometimes we do the wrong thing in responding. We realize that after, that wasn't the best thing to do. So then we learn from that. So next time we do something a little bit different and improve. If we want, in any difficult situation, if we want to know, is this absolutely the right thing to do? I think most of the time we're not going to be able to do anything because we're not going to know for sure if this is the right thing to do. And often not doing anything is not a good option, particularly if they're physically attacking us, to sit there and let them, you know, beat us. That's not going to be the best thing to do, for sure. So we have to often make a response, and using wisdom and compassion as best we can. And if we just find out that that wasn't the best thing to do, we learn from that and try and improve the next time. I mean, that's all we can do.
There are some literatures which talk about... Which talk about what we eat transform into our thoughts and probably translates into anger, frustration. So is this something which is also related in Buddhism?
So of course within Buddhism the key element is the mind and working with the mind. But of course the mind is not something separate from the body. They're very closely related. So of course also in Buddhism you will see some discussions in various contexts about looking after the body, having a healthy diet, exercise, getting enough sleep and all that, because the body is the support for the mind. And certainly when we talk about the much higher levels of practice of Tantra or Vajrayana, where we're dealing with very subtle levels of mind and also we're dealing with very subtle energies in the body, then at that point you'll find that what you put into your body, you'll notice much more. Like, for example, you know, I like often to have a coffee or so every day and I don't really notice much of an impact. But if I go into retreat and have retreat for a few weeks, and usually I don't drink coffee in a retreat, but then I have a coffee, wow, do I really notice how the coffee has a big impact on my mind. So when we get really into the more subtle, higher areas of practice, you will notice that if you start putting like sugar and things into your body, you'll notice how it has a very strong impact, negative impact on your mind. But of course, at our level, our mind is very sluggish and not very trained. So even if we have a coffee or have some sugar, we really probably don't notice much of a change in our mind. But as we progress, we will notice those changes more. So you'll find that as we advance in the practice, then it becomes more and more essential to really look after the body, because those very subtle changes in the body can really have an impact in the mind.
In this context, why don't we eat onions and garlic?
And that's the reason, is that because in Tantra or Vajrayana practice, and we'll talk more about that later, there are levels of tantric practice. Generally, they talk about four levels. And the first level of tantric practice emphasizes what's more called external yoga. We can talk about external yoga and internal yoga. Internal yoga is the mind. External yoga is the body and environment. That's much easier to work with. So at the initial level of tantric practice, they also put a lot of emphasis on that for the reason that I mentioned. So at that level of tantric practice, they often talk about, you know, right sort of cleanliness, right sort of food. And it's said that it's considered that things like onion, garlic and so forth can agitate the mind. But again, at our level, if we eat onion and garlic, we probably don't notice any change. But once we get to that level of practice, things like that, you will notice that impact on the mind. Just as at that level, if you have a little bit of coffee, you will definitely notice that agitating the mind. So at that level then, because to control those external things like what we eat and so forth is easier than to control the mind. So then at that level, there's more emphasis on that because that can really help to support us at that level of practice.
For me, yoga is more related to Hinduism. So what's yoga in Tibetan Buddhism?
Yeah. Yoga, of course, the word yoga, usually when we see the word yoga, we think that means these physical asanas. But even in the yoga system, that's one of, I think, 8 levels of things that we do, one of the very beginning levels. So yoga is a whole system, and of course at the higher levels it's all about meditation, not physical bodywork. But at the initial stages, the physical bodywork, of course, provides a good support for that. And so also in Buddhism, in Tibetan Buddhism, we also have those yogic exercises. But again, generally you won't find any mention of those until you get to the level of Tantra. And then at that level of practice, these yogic exercises are not so much about making this coarse body fit and flexible. It's more about aligning subtle energies in the body. So it's usually a much more subtle level of yogic practice. Of course, you do physical exercises, but again, the goal is not so much to be more flexible in this body, but to balance subtle energies in the body. Because by balancing the subtle energies, you're helping to balance the subtle mind, which we are working with in Tantra or Vajrayana.
Like the chakras. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Any other questions from discussion group anyone would like to bring up? Yeah.
You didn't understand that. I mean, we're not the body, we're not the mind.
Yeah, yeah.
And Buddhism doesn't really talk about soul, you said, so...
Well, I said they don't use the word soul.
Self,
yeah. I mean, this is going to be a big topic which we're going to cover in a couple of days' time. We're going to spend a whole day on the talking about the nature of reality. But to give a very brief answer now, we can talk about, again, the same idea of cognitive fusion that we talked about this morning. You know, normally we identify ourselves with our behaviour, you know, or we identify and then we end up with low self-esteem because I'm just a bad person. Or we identify ourselves with our emotions. I'm an angry person. I'm an angry person. That's me. You better accept that. You know, things like that. Not helpful. And we identify with our personality. You know, I'm just that sort of person. You better accept that. That's me. But also, we identify with the body and the mind. This is me. Or the mind is me. Right. But generally, again, intellectually, if we think about it, we may be able to sort of appreciate we're not the body and we're not the mind, maybe. But again, experientially, that's not how we see ourselves. Experientially, instinctively, we have a sense, this is me. Or if something going on in the mind, this is me. That's how we instinctively see ourselves. And from a Buddhist perspective, this is a false view of person. And that's going to lead to the mental afflictions and suffering. But then, of course, the big question is, if I'm not my body and my mind, who am I? And we're going to answer that question in a couple of days' time. But again, the short answer is, there is a me, there is a person, you do exist. No Buddhist tradition says that there's no me, no person. Yes and no. I mean, again, I want to clarify that because also there's a lot of confusion about that. And we're going to start to talk about that already tomorrow. And then again, in a couple of days' time, I'm going to talk about that more. But to really answer that well, I need to bring in a lot of other ideas first. But don't worry, it's coming.
We are not so.
To answer that question, I would have to first ask you, what is your definition of the word soul? Because I think even in Christianity, there are many different definitions of what the word soul means. So that's why it's difficult. Well, in fact, I can't answer that question unless you clearly tell me, what do you mean by the word soul?
Inner consciousness.
Inner consciousness. inner consciousness. So inner consciousness is mind. So yes, we are not the mind. So in that case, yes, we're not the soul. If your definition of soul is inner consciousness, we have an inner consciousness. So according to your definition, we have a soul. Therefore, we can't be the soul. If we have something, we can't be it, by definition. I'm not sure what that means. It's a nice word. Spiritual DNA.
I read it in a book.
Spiritual DNA.
Then does that mean my soul exists if my soul is my spiritual DNA?
Again, I have no idea what you mean by the word spiritual DNA.
Okay, well, if we go from one life to the next, with Sankara, karma from the last life,
sure,
then our karma spiritual DNA, right?
So then we have spiritual DNA.
Yeah.
So if we have spiritual DNA, we can't be spiritual DNA. Can we? No, I mean, really. Think simply. If we have something, we can't be it. It's impossible. So yes, if that's your definition of spiritual DNA, yes, we do have spiritual DNA. Therefore, we're not spiritual DNA because it's something we have. But again, I'm going to talk about this.
Is that excluded from being a part of us, or does it just...
No, we have... No, of course, then in that definition, spiritual DNA is part of us, just like the body's part of us and the mind is part of us. Of course. Of course. Absolutely.
Are you talking about the difference between mind and consciousness later more?
Yes, we're going to be talking more about that, yes.
It's different in Buddhism
idea. Again, when we speak generally, mind equals consciousness. But when we speak in specific contexts, as we're going to see a little bit more, they can take on a slightly different meaning.
Slightly.
Yeah. And again, unfortunately, different translators use the same English word to translate different Sanskrit terms, and then there's mass confusion. Or different translators translate the same Sanskrit term with different English words, and then there's confusion. So that's why when we talk about important concepts, I always like to go back to the Sanskrit and say, this is what we're talking about. Then it's clear. Any other questions from discussion group? Okay. So let's move on to this afternoon's topic. So we're currently looking at the second noble truth. Second noble truth, of course, is the cause or origin of dukkha or suffering. Why are we stuck in this state of dukkha, this unsatisfactory state, our human condition? And we saw this morning that there are two underlying causes. The first being the mental afflictions, which we briefly looked at this morning. And within those mental afflictions, we saw that the three primary or core mental afflictions are ignorance, attachment, and aversion. And of those three, the root is ignorance. Ignorance here, of course, is a misunderstanding of the nature of reality. Specifically, it's a belief and grasping onto an independent me, an independent objective world. As we saw, that leads to attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things, and then the whole cycle starts. And then those are mental afflictions are driving our behaviour, and every action we do, motivated by mental affliction, has a result, has a consequence. And so that's the second of the truth of origin, is our actions. So That's what we're going to look at this afternoon. And action in Sanskrit, of course, is karma. So karma is the Buddhist theory of the law of cause and effect in terms of our actions and our experiences. Now, of course, the Buddhist theory of karma is embedded in the Buddhist worldview. It's part of that. So what we need to appreciate is that we need to check our assumptions. For example, if we have, as our worldview, if we have a materialistic worldview, and our view is that the mind is nothing more than the brain, then, or the world is only matter and energy, then some of the ideas in karma will not make sense. If our worldview is that my mind began at the beginning of this life and it will end at the end of this life, meaning our worldview is not conservation of consciousness. Our worldview is the mind begins at the beginning of this life and ends at the end of this life, a lot of these ideas of karma will not make sense. And if our worldview is that there is an independent me here and an independent objective world there, again, a lot of these ideas in karma will not make sense. So these principles of karma are embedded within the worldview that the mind is not the brain. The mind did not begin at the beginning of this life. It's a continuum, beginningless continuum, and it's embedded in the worldview of the interconnected nature of reality. So we just need to keep that in mind. Otherwise, a lot of these things will definitely not make any sense. So on that, let's begin. So when we talk about karma, karma literally means action. But when we talk about the theory of karma, we're not just talking about the actual action itself. We're talking about the whole process. And the process is that we do an action, and that action leaves an effect on our mind, and that often is explained using a concept called imprint. That our action leaves an imprint on our mind, and that imprint is carried along the mind, and then later that imprint will ripen as an experience. So when we talk about the theory of karma, we're really talking about the whole process. But technically, the word karma is meaning action. So let's have a look at some basic principles of this theory. We can talk about two types of karma. Because when we talk about action, the most important thing in action is intention or motivation. That's what's going to primarily determine the result. So when we point to what is actually the karma, we can talk about the mental factor of intention. And then we can talk about intended actions, meaning the intended actions are our verbal and physical actions motivated by our intention. So karma or action can be mental, verbal, or physical. So karma is not just the things we say and do. Karma is also the things we think. For example, if we have a thought of wanting to hurt someone, that is already karma. That's already an action. And then, of course, on top of that, we can act that out verbally or physically. That's also, of course, karma. So we shouldn't think that if we just have these negative, harmful thoughts, there's no consequences. There are. Already there is karma in action. But, of course, we can understand that acting out those negative thoughts is much more forceful. And we'll talk more about that later. And then we can talk about, remember, the result of our actions is our experiences. And our experiences, we saw, can be unpleasant suffering experiences, pleasant happiness experiences, or neutral experiences. So because we can have three types of experiences, we can talk about three types of karma which lead to those experiences. So we can talk about virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral karma. Virtuous karma is any action which leads to a happiness result. A non-virtuous karma or action is any action leading to a suffering result. And a neutral karma is any action leading to a neutral result. So this is three types of karma in terms of the result. Here we have two types of karma in terms of whether it's just mental or whether we act it out verbally and physically. So any questions so far? Which one? This, right. So remember, karma is the Buddhist theory of law of cause and effect in terms of our actions and our experiences. And our experiences are three types: suffering, unpleasant experiences, pleasant happiness experiences, or neutral experiences. So because we can have three types of experiences, we can talk about three types of actions which cause those experiences. So virtuous karma is any action that leads to a happiness result. Non-virtuous karma is any action that leads to suffering result, and neutral karma is any action leading to a neutral result. Now, what we need to appreciate here, when we say result, we need to understand in every action, there are two things, probably more, but in every action we do, there is the immediate consequence of that action, and then there is the result of that action, the karmic result. So, for example, let's say we steal some money, that action. So, this is a non-virtuous action, stealing. So, the result of that is suffering. But of course, generally when we steal, the immediate consequence is we have money and we may be happy. That is not the karmic result of that action. When we do an action, that leaves an imprint in our mind. So even though we steal money and immediately we have money in our hand, that stealing has left an imprint in our mind, and that will ripen into an experience. And as we're going to shortly see, the experience is always of a similar type to the action. Meaning, if we steal, the karmic result of that, which will come later, is to see someone stealing something from us. So then that's what we mean when we talk about the result of our actions. We're not talking about what are the immediate consequences of what I do. These are not the result of our action. And in fact, this is the main problem here, is this gap, this time gap between action and experience. If there was no time gap, if the result happened immediately, we would never steal, because as soon as we're stealing, we'd see someone taking money from us. Then we go, okay, I better not steal then. But because we steal, and then maybe 10 years later someone takes something from us, we don't connect the idea, oh, that's because I stole before. We don't connect the two. But this is what we're talking about here in terms of the result of our actions. We're not talking about the immediate consequences. We're talking about what happens later.
What if you do with bad things for good reasons?
Right, so that's my next point. So we can talk about three types of actions here, but often our actions are mixed. We have a good intention, but we create suffering. Or we even have a bad intention, but we do some benefit. So then we have a mixed result, meaning the good intention will lead to happiness, the causing suffering will lead to suffering. So what we need to understand here in this theory, as with Buddhism in general, is these are concepts to explain processes. Like the example that we have a concept of bowl to help us explain the flow of change. So that idea of bowl is useful, but we don't have a single, stable, unchanging bowl here. So likewise here, these are concepts to help us explain the process. So we need to sort of keep that in mind. Yeah?
What about karma's without intention? I can have a thought which is non-virtuous without having the intention to produce it.
Yeah, but a non-virtuous thought is already intention.
You should have it in your mind.
So I'm not sure what you mean.
For example, when I walk and I step on an ant.
Right. This is coming later. This is coming later in terms of the strength of our actions. But a brief answer now is, of course, there's a difference between doing something that is harmful, knowing it's harmful, versus doing the same thing, not understanding it's harmful. Of course, they're both negative actions, but doing a harmful behaviour and knowing it's harmful will have a bigger negative result than if we do exactly the same thing out of ignorance. But ignorance is not an escape. It's not like, oh, I didn't know, and there's no result, but the result will be much less, of course. But that's coming a little bit later in the presentation.
If I do something that is like stealing, my karma would be something about stealing, or maybe it would be
I'm going to give more detail, so maybe we can hold off on the questions unless it's exactly related to this, because I think a lot of the questions are probably about things I haven't explained yet.
Any action I do has a positive intention towards me. Nobody does anything if it's not positive for them. Nobody does anything.
Oh, I think a lot of people do self-harm.
Okay. Through their scale, through the way they see or perceive the world or have learned about the world, they do something that they think would be beneficial to them. At that point, with that knowledge...
There's no wisdom there. So we can do a lot of things for ourselves that are very harmful for ourselves. Can't we? And even sometimes people punish themselves deliberately. They punish themselves.
Let's say I pollute the environment with my business.
Right.
But I think that making money that way, I don't sit in my office and go all evil and have like terrible thoughts. I think I was brought up, I have the notion that this is good. I am doing good.
Correct. So again, ignorance is not an escape. But doing that, polluting the environment, not understanding that you're polluting the environment, versus doing exactly the same thing, knowing that you're polluting the environment, the big difference in terms of the magnitude of the result. But just because we're ignorant doesn't mean we avoid the result. But if we knowingly do something harmful, we have a much bigger result.
So not being ignorant is always environmental or perspective? Always?
Well, again, the wisdom at the deepest level from a Buddhist perspective is based on the interconnected nature of everything. So therefore, if we understand that, we would never pollute knowingly. Because harming the world is harming ourselves, effectively.
If you kill someone from self-defense, you said before that you separated, I had good intentions, I didn't want to kill that person, obviously, but I ended up in a bad action. How does karma relate to that?
Yeah, so again, we can have mixed actions. Good intentions, bad behavior. Bad intentions, good actions. And so then we have, depending on those variations, we have those two results.
So will there be a result if you kill
someone? Yeah, of course. There's always a result if there's mental afflictions involved. But again, maybe I need to give more, because I think maybe a lot of these questions will be answered by the presentations that I'm coming up with here. So let's move on to the next presentation. And here we can talk about four general principles of karma. And these four general principles are basically the same general principles that we see in the physical world of cause and effect. We know in the physical world there is a law of cause and effect operating. And that physical world of law of cause and effect follows certain principles. And here, in the internal world of cause and effect in terms of actions and experiences, we have the same four general principles operating. And the first is that karma or action is certain or definite. What this means is, just as in the physical world, if you plant an apple seed, you'll always get an apple tree. It's not like sometimes you plant an apple seed and sometimes you get an orange tree. Meaning the result is always of the same type to the cause. That's what we mean by certain or definite. Meaning if we do a virtuous action, we always get a happiness result. If we do a non-virtuous action, we always get a suffering result. It's not like sometimes we do a virtuous action and end up with a suffering result. So the law of cause and effect is that the result is always of the same type as the cause. That's what certain or definite means. The second general principle is the principle of increase. And here, again in the physical world, we can plant a small seed and end up with a big tree. So from a small cause, we can have a big result. Likewise, particularly, of course, if we nurture that seed, if we give it water and fertilizer and so forth. Similarly, in theory of karma, we can do a small action and end up with a big result. Again, if we nurture that, and by nurturing that action, it means that we were happy that we did it, and we keep doing it again and again and again, then we can end up with a big result. So the same here, this idea of increase.
Can you give an example?
Like, we can do a small act of generosity. You know, we can give some food to a beggar. And if our motivation is very pure, I want to do that really to help them, I'm very happy to do that, I'm going to keep giving to these beggars. Now, normally you would expect that if we give a certain amount of food, the result is we would see more or less something similar back. But here, if we give that food with a very good motivation and very happy to do it and rejoicing that we did it and keep doing it, we can get a big result. Maybe we get something huge return. So that's an example. Similarly, on the negative side, of course, if we do some little negative action, but we're very happy to do that and we keep doing it, we can have a big result.
Does the result always have to be physical, or can it be like an emotional benefit?
It's an experience.
Yeah. So when you give to the beggar, for example, and you keep giving, you're not saying that you necessarily have to get this, it's not like you get a mansion the next day, it's that you get this amazing sense of fulfillment and long-lasting happiness.
It's a similar types in terms of experience, but there's more coming in yet. Yeah. Okay. The third general principle is not done, no result. Again, as with the physical world, if you don't plant the seed, you're never going to get a tree. Meaning if you don't create the cause, you will never get a result. Similarly here, if you don't do the action, you can't get the result, the experience. So again here, basically, every result has a cause. And the fourth general principle is not wasted. Again, similarly to the physical world, if you plant a seed in the ground, definitely there's a seed in the ground. It's not like sometimes you plant the seed and it just disappears. Of course, whether or not that seed results in a tree is not certain. If we give it a lot of water and fertilizer, we get a big tree. If we don't give it any fertilizer, a little bit of water, maybe we get a small tree. If we give it no water, maybe we get no tree. But there's still a seed there. Likewise, if we do an action, definitely there's an imprint in our mind. It's not like some actions we do sort of get lost. There's definitely an imprint in our mind if we do an action. But what happens to that imprint is not certain. If we nurture it by being happy about doing it and doing it again and again, we can get a big result. If we don't nurture it, we're not doing it again and again, and we're not really very happy about it, smaller result. If we don't nurture it at all, and we actually maybe, like, if there's a seed in the ground, we can put poison in the ground and then there's nothing, the seed can't produce anything. Likewise, with the imprint, we can do things to make sure that that imprint never ripens. And this brings in the whole idea of purification in Buddhism. The idea that we can purify our mind of these negative imprints. Because if we have negative imprints in our mind, these are going to result in some sort of future suffering experience. But we don't necessarily have to experience those results if we purify our mind of these negative imprints, like putting poison in the ground. How that purification process works, we're going to talk about tomorrow morning, what we can do to purify our mind of these negative imprints. So these are the four general principles of karma, basically the same principles that are operating in the physical world of cause and effect. Any questions about those?
You said karma is not wasted, but can you undo it, or can you
undo it? Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Purification is, you put a seed in the ground, it's not like it just disappears. Can we stop it from producing a tree? Absolutely. We don't just give it any water, we can even poison it. Then the seed doesn't produce anything, does it? Likewise, we do a harmful action, we have an imprint in our mind, it doesn't disappear, but we can stop it from producing a result. This is purification. So that's what we're going to, the process of how to do that, we're going to look at tomorrow morning.
You said that karma, you do one thing, and after a time, another thing.
Well, you have an experience.
Yeah, you have an experience. So there is a possible way that you do one thing and you get several experiences.
Again, remember, I mentioned that this is concepts to understand the process. So we need to be careful in not making them into very discrete things. Because then, like, you know, bowl is a concept to understand process. But if we make that into a thing, then we're not really understanding the process. So similarly here, these are concepts to understand the process. And so what you find to help understand that process, in some Buddhist traditions, they have concepts where one action can lead to a number of results, or number of actions can lead to one result. But again, it's not like these separate things, it's just the process. So whatever helps us to understand the process. Yeah, so that's the answer, basically.
For the intention, it's thoughts. What if you have thoughts like, this person annoys me, but you don't have any intention of harming? Is that still negative karma? Or?
Right, so what we need to understand is, in the present moment, there are two things going on. There's the experience, and then there's how we react or respond to that. Having an experience is not karma. It's the result of karma. What we do with that experience, how we react or respond, is producing new karma. So if we have that come up, and then we engage in that, or react, or do something about it, then we're planting new seeds. So we're not doing karma having an experience. It's what, how we react or respond to that will determine whether or not we're producing new karmic imprints.
Just to understand, you can, let's say I give food to a beggar, but my intention was my good karma.
Yeah. And so this is something I was going to mention, it's coming up, but I'll bring it in now, and it's something I'm going to talk a little bit more about later. But again, the main factor here is intention. And if we have an intention of doing something generous so people will think we're a good person, that's a generous act, and there will be some happiness result. But if we do that same action selflessly, and maybe anonymously, wishing to benefit that person, big result.
Okay.
So
no,
intention.
No problem. I'm speaking.
Yeah.
Let's say you do it.
So what I'm saying, is that, and this is something I was going to bring up later, but I'll bring it in now because it's relevant. Is often people feel, oh, I'm not going to help that person because I have a selfish motivation.
Okay. So that's not.
That's not okay. Because actually, for us at our level, it's nearly impossible to do a completely unselfish act. Nearly impossible. Because we even have a little bit of selfishness expecting them to say thank you. Really? No? If we give something and they don't say thank you, go. That's selfishness at a very little level. So here the Dalai Lama gives very good advice. You know, because we often talk about being completely unselfish in our actions, But he understands that in our modern society, we're very selfish because our modern society promotes that. You know, look after number one. You're the most important. Forget about everyone else. You're number one. That's how society promotes that. And so for us to be not selfish is very difficult. And so Dalai Lama, when he gives a talk in the West to a big audience, he goes, okay, if you have to be selfish, at least be smart selfish. Now we're dumb selfish, meaning anyone who gets in our way, we harm them. Anyone who stands in our way, we harm them. That's dumb selfishness, because we just receive suffering. Smart selfishness says, okay, my happiness is dependent on what the people around me. So if I do something good for them, I hope we're more likely to get something good from them. That's smart selfishness. So that's where we start. We start by doing good things with a selfish motivation, because that's all we're really capable of, most of us at our level. And then we keep doing that. And then what we'll notice is that over time, the joy we get from merely giving will far outweigh anything we're hoping to get in return. Like I had the earlier example, the study they did about the $100. The group who had to spend the $100 on themselves versus the group who had to spend the $100 on others had a higher level of happiness at the end of the day. So that's where we need to start. So it's not very good to have this attitude, I'm not going to help them because I have a selfish motivation. I think we won't start to do anything. No.
My concern, and maybe it's just a lack of understanding, but that karma can promote a blame the victim attitude.
I was hoping someone would bring this up. This is a classic example of cognitive fusion. Karma can turn into a blame game. Classic example of cognitive fusion. They deserve it. We are fusing the person with their behaviour, which is an invalid perspective. So like someone who's behaving badly, if we do cognitive fusion, we get angry and attack them. If we don't do cognitive fusion, we have compassion for them and help them to overcome their negative behaviour. So turning karma into blame game is a classic example of cognitive fusion. So if we avoid cognitive fusion, if someone's suffering, rather than go, they deserve it, spontaneously we should have compassion. And also, karma implies personal responsibility, if we have the correct perspective and not cognitive fusion. Because again, if we do the cognitive fusion with respect to ourselves and karma, we'll just beat ourselves up. I must have been a bad person. Rather than have compassion for ourselves and overcome that negative behaviour. So this is just another example of cognitive fusion. So very careful to avoid that.
If something really bad happens to you, you get raped or something, then how do you...
Right, yeah, so this is... I need to add a couple more presentations and we'll address these points. This is a very important point, but there's two more things I need to talk about first, so let's wait on that one.
Let's say I stole in a past life, and then I get stolen from in this life.
Again, I think I'd like to answer that first, introducing some things, because when we start asking these questions, we have these false assumptions, like when I did something in a past life. You didn't exist in a past life, did you? You, the me here. So that's what often people go, say if they're having some suffering, oh, I must have been a horrible person in my past life. No? No, but okay, go on. Go on. No, go on.
What about the person stealing from me now? Doesn't it sort of perpetuate? Like someone, there needs to be karmic retribution or karmic results for actions, right?
Sure, there are.
But
unless we purify them.
Someone has to do the negative action that is karmic retribution.
Well, retribution, I wouldn't use the word retribution.
Karmic result.
Karmic result, yeah.
But it does require another person. Right?
Another person.
To steal from me.
Not necessarily.
Action that is karma the result of the negative action that I or...
It doesn't have to be another person. It doesn't have to be another person.
It has to be a similar...
result.
Yeah.
But you could lose something
okay.
without being stolen. You know, it could disappear or fall down the hill or something. So you've lost it. So that's still... So it doesn't have to be another person, but it has to be a similar sort of experience of you losing.
But wait, what about that experience? What if someone steals from her, let's say, because she stole something? So her action kind of trapped somebody else, or is it like an interaction?
No, it's just, it's conditions. It's, she, you can't cause anyone. So that's why yesterday I brought in this very important point, substantial cause and cooperative condition. You can't be the substantial cause for someone stealing. Impossible. You can be a condition, but you're not the cause. So we need to be very clear about that. Otherwise, we have some strange ideas. Okay. Two more presentations and then probably more questions. Or very quick, yes.
I know people that are really good, but they have bad luck.
Again, it's coming. The answer to that question is coming. Okay. So basically, when we understand these general principles and this presentation here, what we can appreciate is that suffering comes from harmful behaviour, pleasant happiness experience comes from virtuous behaviour. So by understanding this, that would hopefully motivate us to adopt an ethical lifestyle. So what I'd like to do now, and this comes in the presentation of karma, is how to adopt that ethical lifestyle. And remember, we talked about karma can be mental, verbal, and physical. So also, ethical behaviour needs to be... We need to cover mental, verbal, and physical behaviour in our ethics. And the Buddha explained what's called the 10 non-virtues are 10 non-virtuous actions that we should avoid if we want to have a good basis for ethical behaviour. 3 of those are physical behaviour, 4 verbal behaviour, and 3 mental behaviour. And generally, when we talk about the virtues, engaging in virtuous behaviour, it's presented as simply abandoning or giving up the non-virtuous behaviour. And personally, I think that's not a very good way to present it, because, again, in our modern society, we are so much focused on the negative that even saying, I don't want to kill, what we're still focusing on is killing. For example, I think it was Mother Teresa said, I will never attend an anti-war rally, but I will always attend a peace rally. And I think also in our modern society, we don't like when people tell us what we can't do, what not to do. And another classic example is that there's a modern philosopher, William James, who says that what we attend to becomes our reality. So even if we're attending to stopping war, that's our reality, fighting in war. Whereas much better is to focus on peace, the positive opposite. And it feels much nicer as well. So what I'd like to do is present the 10 virtues in terms of presenting the positive opposite, so that we can start to focus on the positives rather than simply focusing on stopping the negative. Because I think it's much more helpful, particularly in our modern society. So we can talk about the 10 virtues. And the first 3 are physical behaviours. The non-virtue, the first one, is killing. So what's the positive opposite of killing?
Preserving life.
Preserving life. Preserving life is very proactive. So I think the minimum positive opposite would simply be respect life. And then, of course, on top of that, if we want to be more proactive, we can preserve life.
But at least respect life.
Now, here often comes the question, do you have to be a vegetarian to be a Buddhist? And the answer is no. What we can understand is, in terms of not killing or respecting life, we can do that at many levels. Of course, at the very basic level, we would have to stop killing humans, because, of course, if we kill humans, we end up in jail. The next level would be stop killing animals, and then maybe the next level is stop killing animals indirectly by eating meat. And then, of course, the next level was stop harming animals indirectly by becoming vegan. But then, of course, if we're vegan and we're not organic, we're not eating organic, then animals are being killed through pesticides and sprays, so we should become organic vegan. But even if we're organic vegan, harvesting grains and digging vegetables out of the ground kills a lot of bugs, so we should not eat any grains or vegetables that come out of the ground. So actually then we should only eat fruit that drops from trees, but even that may crush some bugs. So actually maybe we better not eat at all. And actually we better not actually walk out the door because we could accidentally step on a bug. And even if we stay at home, we could accidentally inhale a fly or mosquito, so we better put a mask over our face. So what we can see is that actually to live this life, it's impossible to have a life where there's no harm. What this is saying is, in the best practical way for us as an individual, to try to minimize the negative impact. So, of course, if we can be organic vegan in a practical way, it would be great. If not, vegan. If not, vegetarian. And, of course, in Tibet previously, if you were vegetarian, basically you died because there was not enough nutrition. So you had to eat meat in Tibet. But, of course, now in India, they don't. And His Holiness Dalai Lama very much encourages Tibetans to become vegetarian because it's practical. It's possible. So therefore, here, for us as an individual, I think a good way to do this is we as an individual, at the best possible level, practical level, try to minimise negative impact on other people and other beings in the planet. And that's all we can do. And what we shouldn't do is take the moral high ground and condemn people who are not operating at our level. You know, I'm vegan, you're not vegan, you're a bad person. This, of course, is cognitive fusion. Rather, if someone we feel is harming, we, instead of cognitive fusion, we have compassion for them and try and help them to have less harm in their life. The second non-virtue is stealing. So what's the positive opposite of stealing? Again, generosity is very proactive. What would be the minimum positive opposite?
Respect
others' property. And of course, if we want to be more proactive, we can be generous and give. The third non-virtue is sexual misconduct. And sexual misconduct is any sexual activity that creates harm for ourselves and others. So what's the positive opposite of sexual misconduct? This is a little bit more difficult. What's the positive opposite of sexual misconduct? In fact, some years ago when I mentioned this, almost immediately, and I have to say it was an Australian man who responded, almost immediately he said, sexual conduct. What's the positive opposite of sexual misconduct?
Respect.
Exactly. It's again to respect others or others' boundaries or however you want to put it, respect others.
Sorry?
Didn't hear.
And the sexual misconduct can be also
betrayal. Yeah, anything that creates harm. Yeah, cheating on your partner. Yes. Yeah, of course. So those are the physical actions. Then we have four verbal behaviors. The next non-virtue is lying. So what's the positive opposite of lying?
Honesty.
Yeah, honesty, telling the truth. The next, the fifth non-virtue is what's called divisive speech. And divisive speech is any speech where your intention is to cause two people or two groups of people to move apart. So you're actively trying to divide people.
Uniting.
What's the positive opposite of that?
Uniting.
Uniting, bringing people together, yes. Well, okay, yeah.
Promoting harmony,
yeah, sure. More respectful. Sure, sure. The sixth one, the non-virtue, is harsh speech. And harsh speech is defined as any speech whereby your intention is to hurt the person by what you say. So what's the opposite of harsh speech?
Gentle,
kind speech. Kind speech or gentle, yeah, kind. The seventh non-virtue is what's called senseless speech or idle gossip. Now, here we're talking about the top 10 list from the Buddha. But senseless speech or idle gossip seems pretty harmless. Why does it make the top 10 list? We waste so much time, exactly. So what's the positive opposite of senseless speech or idle gossip?
Smart speech.
Meaningful speech.
Can you explain it again?
Yeah. So the non-virtue is senseless speech or idle gossip. And it makes the top 10 list because we waste a lot of our time just speaking about nothing for no purpose. So the positive opposite, of course, is to engage in meaningful speech. Then, of course, we need to address mental attitudes. So we have three positive mental attitudes. So the eighth non-virtue is often translated in English by a word called covetousness. Not often used, but that's how it's often translated. Covetousness being basically wanting something belonging to someone else. So, of course, that can lead to stealing and lying and so forth. So what's the positive opposite of covetousness? And here I can think of two things. What? Contentment. Exactly. Being content with what we have. And what's the other one? Rejoicing in others, good fortune, exactly. Instead of being jealous. The ninth non-virtue is translated often as ill will or malice. And this is the mind which wishes harm on others or wishing harm to befall others. So what's the positive opposite of wishing that harm befall someone else? So, yeah, loving kindness and compassion, wishing them happiness and to be free of harm or suffering. So we can talk about loving kindness and compassion. Sorry? Maitri in Sanskrit, yeah. And compassion in Sanskrit is karuna. And then the tenth non-virtue is called wrong view. And here, the main wrong view we're talking about is the view that there are no consequences to my actions, I can do whatever I want. So, of course, that will lead to a lot of non-virtuous behaviour. So what's the positive opposite of wrong view?
Right view,
or we could say wisdom. So these are the three verbal, mental attitudes. Now, this is the order they're presented in, and generally it's presented in terms of the heaviness of the actions. That if you do something physical, usually that is more heavy than verbal, more heavy than mental. But yes, that's the normal order they're presented in. So I think if we want to adopt an ethical lifestyle, I think it's much nicer and helpful, rather than just saying, I don't want to kill and steal and so forth, rather to focus on the positive opposites. Because that's what we attend to. So if we attend to respecting life, that becomes our reality. So I think this is a very nice list to use, whether we're Buddhist, non-Buddhist, or I think in any ethical lifestyle, this would be a good basis for adopting ethical lifestyle.
Is this from one sutra?
The ten non-virtues, I'm not sure whether it appears in a number of different sutras. This list, of course, we made up. Because the ten virtues in the text is normally listed as don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, and so forth. But I think this is much nicer to do it this way. Okay. Next presentation, and then some questions. About this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you repeat again the opposite of 9 and 10?
9 is ill will or malice, and that ill will or malice means we want some suffering, someone else to suffer. And 10 is wrong view, and the particular wrong view that's talked about here is the view that there are no consequences to my behaviour, I can do whatever I want. Right, one more presentation and then some questions. We can also talk about karma in terms of four types of result. So we said earlier that the result, our experience, or our result, is always of a similar type to the cause. And we can talk about similar type to the cause in two ways. We can talk about similar experience, meaning again, if we steal, a result can be we can experience something being taken from us or we losing something. So that's similar type of experience to the action. But we can also talk about similar type of result in terms of similar tendency. Meaning that, again, if we steal, a result of that can be to develop the habit to steal. So that similar tendency, that a result of that action is to develop and increase the tendency to do that action again. So that's also a result. Then we can talk about what's called environmental result. An environmental result is talking about how we experience the world around us. So what we can understand is that, let's say we're doing some harmful behavior and that's ripening, then the environmental result of that would be that we experience a very harsh, or we experience the world in a very harsh way. And we can sort of understand this in a very simple way in terms of, you know, when we're angry, when we're caught up in anger, even if it's a beautiful environment, it doesn't look very attractive in that sense. And of course, to really appreciate this at a deeper level, as I mentioned right at the beginning, we have to appreciate the Buddhist view of reality, the idea of the interconnected nature of reality, the idea that there's not a fixed objective world there, that actually the world is really a product of our mind. So if we can understand that, this will make more sense. If we really believe there is a fixed objective world there, this probably won't make much sense. And then, right, so the environmental result is in terms of how we experience the world around us. So if we keep it simple, we can say that if we're engaging in harmful behavior and that's ripening, we're going to experience the world in a very negative, harsh way.
Mm-hmm. So that's generic, like no matter what the harmful behavior, I'll experience the world as a more...
Depending on the type of negative behavior, we'll have different types of experiences, but it'll be not a very pleasant way of seeing the world. Yeah, like maybe if we're stealing, we'll see the world as lacking resources. You know, that there's nothing out there for me, even though there may be. But we'll see it in that way. If we're engaged in a lot of stealing, one result here can be what we perceive is a lack, that there's nothing there for me. In fact, there may be, but we don't. We see it in that way. The last one is called the fully ripened result. What this means is that the very life we have now is a result. So fully ripened result is actually talking about an actual life. So the fact that we're born now as a human is a result, is this fully ripened result. And at the end of this life, one karmic imprint will ripen to determine what type of life we have in the next life. And so that's the fully ripened result. And we're going to talk about that process in detail tomorrow morning, how that works. But this is what the fully ripened result is talking about. It's talking about an actual existence. So this life is the fully ripened result. But of course, in this life, in every moment, other imprints are ripening for all the various experiences we have in this life. So these are the four types of result. Any questions there? Again, we'll talk about that in detail tomorrow morning.
Is environmental result like collective karma? Is that...
So again, in the original Indian and Tibetan texts, I've never seen the term collective karma. It may be there, but in the texts I've studied, I've never seen that. Having said that, often you'll find Tibetan teachers talk a little bit about collective karma. But again, what we can understand, particularly if we understand the interconnected nature of reality, we can understand that we're not in isolation. And so everything's interconnected. So in that sense, we can talk about maybe this idea of collective karma. But we have to be a little bit careful when we talk about that, not to get some strange idea what that means. It's really just talking about the interconnected nature of reality. And again, I've never seen that term in any of the original texts.
But how does karma speak about, like, countries that have chronic poverty or...
Again, we're just in that environment together, and we're experiencing those similar experiences. I think there's nothing more than that.
So it's not a result.
What's not a result?
Like countries that experience chronic poverty, or I mean, it's more.
Again, remember, one thing is karma is personal. We can't transfer karma. We can't take karma from anyone. It's personal experience. Within personal experience, we can have similarities with other people, of course. But it's not transferable.
Say I'm reading a newspaper. I'm reading a newspaper.
Yeah.
And it has a lot of harsh and negative events reported, and that gets imprinted on my mind. So I get a very harsh view of reality. But at the same time, it's making me less ignorant because I'm being more aware about what's happening and how the picture really is and what the world is really like.
So again, merely reading that is not creating karma. It's how we respond or react to that will determine karma. So if we read that and then react to that with anger and so forth, then that's not so useful. So we can read that, and if we can learn from that, then fine, that's good. So what we don't want to do is allow that to take over our mind and for us to develop these negative attitudes, which of course we need to be very careful about.
But isn't the karma here reading the paper because
no.
that's the action?
No.
And this is the environmental result that I'm viewing the world as a very...
No. I mean, again, as I said here before, in every given moment there are two things going on. There's the result, the experience, which is reading, and then what we do with that, how we react or respond to that, will determine if we're planting karmic seeds or not. Simply reading it, we're not.
Just to go back to the earlier question, like cognitive melding.
Cognitive fusion, yeah.
Right. If karma is personal, then does that is the implication then of people who have been raped or who are handicapped are suffering because of their previous actions?
Again, so here, one point, and then we'll go into the question, is that when we do an action, there's no such thing as instant karma. You know, it's not like we do an action and we experience a result instantly. We can have immediate consequences of our actions, but that's not the actual result. So in the text, it talks about we can experience the results of our actions in three top points. Either a little bit later in this life, in the next life, or sometime in the future. Or the fourth option is never, if we purify that negative action.
Okay, with temporal stuff aside, it is still a
right. So,
result of that action.
Right. So then when we give these sort of questions, then we need to be careful how we look at those situations. You know? And, you know, we say, well, I must have done something horrible in my past life. And when we say that, we think about this me. But this me didn't exist in a past life. You know, we say, I must have been a horrible person. And the way we think about the I is this I, this body, this mind. And of course, this body, this mind didn't exist in a past life. So we have to be careful when we think about this so we don't end up in that wrong view. But yes, there is a continuity, and there is this law of cause and effect operating. Yeah, physical world.
Like,
yeah, there's a physical world of cause and effect.
Like
how we experience that and react to that, of course, is our personal karma. But, you know, the physical world of cause and effect is not our karma.
Like natural disasters.
Yeah, that's the physical world of cause and effect, yes.
But someone being raped
is a personal experience. But even how we experience the physical world is a personal thing. But the actual unfolding of the causes and effect in the physical world is not to do with our karma. So there's two things there. Any other questions? Yeah.
I was wondering, in the Kabbalah, they tend to explain that until the age of, I think, 1 year, I don't remember exactly, if something happens to a baby, he dies or something, it's a result of the past lives, and after that, it results. Does Buddhism has the same concept?
Yeah. So again, as I just mentioned, the result usually comes in three stages or three possibilities. And often in the Buddhist text it says that what ripens sooner is more heavy actions. Meaning if we have a big motivation, either positive or negative. So if we have a very strong motivation of compassion for everyone, or we have a very strong motivation of wishing to really harm someone, these sorts of strong motivations will mean that that imprint will ripen more soon. But, and so, of course, as a very young child, we can't develop those sorts of intentions. And so, yes, there would be a similar idea there.
But once you but if it happens to a baby, so the family usually suffer more than the baby does, because in that age, you don't really have any conscience. So.
Well, you have a mind, but it's not very operating in extreme cognitive level.
You have this karma.
Yeah.
But it's like, if a baby dies, like you said, so if the family is suffering for the rest of their life, like...
Well, often, if they're suffering for the rest of their life, a little bit, that sometimes is a bit self-induced, if they're suffering that long. Because often, of course, in Buddhism, I think there was a question earlier, is that the goal is not that if some suffering happens, we're sort of blank and we're not affected. This is very unhealthy from a Buddhist perspective. But, and so if some suffering happens, of course we would have a lot of sadness. But if we have a lot of craving and attachment, and that's polluting the sadness, what happens is that sadness degenerates into grief, despair, depression. And then, you know, 5, 10, 20 years later, we're still suffering. And that's because of attachment. And even tragic, more tragic than that, is, and we see this unfortunately, is if there's a couple and one passes away, that attachment even leads to the person hating the person for leaving them behind. I mean, that's tragic. That's attachment. So we don't need to do that. You know, that's not helpful for anybody. You know, if our partners passed away, they wouldn't want us to be despair and depressed for 10 years. They wouldn't want that. And it's not helpful for us. So yes, of course, we would have sadness and we'd go through a process and then we would get on with our life. But that doesn't mean, of course, we forget about them. But if we can really let go of the attachment, we can feel a sort of genuine sadness that's not going to result in some despair and depression and so forth. Okay, I think we've run out of time. Is there last one quick question? Maybe then we'll finish. I can't see, so it's getting dark. Well, death itself is not a karma, of course, but I think what you're pointing to, we're going to be looking at that process and the implications of that tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon. So maybe some more clarity on that tomorrow. Okay. Right, let's leave it there. So we'll have a break now, and then with Renato, you've got two meditations, of course. Let me see what we're meditating on here. I think in the next session you're going to be looking at, in meditation, some ways of dealing with anger. So hopefully that'll be very helpful. And then this evening's meditation is a meditation on cultivating loving kindness. I think maybe for ourselves and others, yeah? Okay, good, very good. And then tomorrow, if you want to prepare in the darkness, what we're going to cover is, as I said, we're going to have a look at the whole death-rebirth process according to Buddhism, and we're going to also look at Buddhist cosmology tomorrow. So if you want to look, read page 8 and 9 tomorrow, and then also in the afternoon, page 22-23 is this diagram here called the Wheel of Life, and there's an explanation next to it. So we're going to be looking, this is Buddhist cosmology, we're going to look at that tomorrow afternoon. So that's the topics for tomorrow. So let's have a break, and Renata will see you at 5:30.